Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we get a preview of WILL's annual vintage vinyl sale. We visit the Mellow Cream Donut Shop in Springfield and the Frasca Flight Simulator Factory in Urbana. We hear one reporter's remembrances of the fall of Saigon on its 30th anniversary, and we find out about the now-famous Pope Chicken. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Feeling a bit hungry for a donut? Well, each morning all across central Illinois, crowds descend upon Mellow Cream stores for their favorite donut. At their store in Springfield, people chat over coffee and donuts created by Mellow Cream since 1932. Tony Bauer, longtime baker at Mellow Cream's Secret Formula Donuts, showed Jiffy Johnson the first step in making donuts.
We get donuts in frozen in boxes. And then we put them on screens.
Now, this is a freezer, and what do you have in here?
We have all the donuts that are going to be done for tonight. And we screen them up ahead of time, and then someone comes in and they defrost them and proof them and fry them, and then they glaze or ice them, whatever, and film whatever needs to be done with them.
So these original shapes here were created at the plant, not here?
They were made at the plant. And then they're boxed and put them in boxes, and then they come over here.
The ones I see in front of me don't have any holes in them. Is this a standard shape for donuts with holes, or what kind of donut is this?
Well, these here are Bismarcks. See, here's the cinnamon roll. Uh-huh. There's Long John's. There's glaze in there. And then there's a rack back here that has, see, a whole bunch of different things on there. And the same with that rack there. They have all the different kinds of donuts that's needed. And we still make our own cake donuts every day. We make old fashioned. That's one of the few things that we have left that we make ourselves anymore.
Now, when you make a cake donut, do you have to start out pretty early in the morning?
They'll start this evening. And that'll be one of the first things the guy does when he comes in is mixes up the cake donuts and makes them. And then he starts on these.
So the donut business doesn't have to start quite as early as, say, the bread business. When do you have to get things ready for your first customers?
We open here at 6 o'clock, but then we deliver wholesale donuts around about 1 o'clock in the morning. They go around to all the bunch of different stores and stuff here in town and deliver donuts then. Here at the stores, they open at 6.
So this is a nighttime business, really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's strictly nights. Always been that way, or early morning hours.
And you're a night owl?
No, I don't come to work till 5:30 in the morning.
You've got it easy now, yeah, but yeah. I bet it wasn't always that way.
No, it used to be you'd come in here at 3 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes you'd come in at midnight and start working. But then, see, back years ago, we would make all the donuts here. We would mix the doughs and cut the donuts all out. And do everything here.
Where do you go to fry pieces that you have?
See, here we got two fryers here.
Now, these are like long sections that you can put the donuts in. They're about 4 feet by 3 feet?
They're about 2 foot by 4 foot. They hold approximately a screen. Usually it's got 4 dozen on it. And so you fry them. It takes about 2.5 to 3 minutes.
So you're just taking that screen right out of the proofing area, and you're putting it directly in this vat and frying it up.
We glaze them over here if they're going to be glazed, and then if they're not going to be glazed, they go on pans and then go in these cabinets.
And the glaze here is, again, a big vat, so you just basically dip the screen, do you, again, into the...
You'll slide the screen of donuts off under here, drop this down in the glaze, and then you take this hopper here and run it across, and it glazes the other side of them.
So you're glazing the top and the bottom.
Right, yeah.
And you can do, again, how many on a panel here?
4 dozen at a time.
So that keeps up with the crowd? They're not too hungry by the time you get done doing all this?
No. No. They probably do 300, 400 dozen a night. or more, depending upon which night of the week you're working. It varies.
We're back in another room now. We've come out of the area where the donuts are fried. What's back here?
This is where all the donuts are filled and with fillings, and they're iced back here.
Mm-hmm. So you actually fill them with what flavors have you got over there?
Well, you got a raspberry, and you got a black raspberry. You got cream, you got lemon, and then you got all the different kinds of icing.
And so this would be hand done?
It is and it isn't. I mean, the icing is done by pans, and the punching has to be done individually.
And you're filling them after they've been cooked, right?
Right. Right. After they've been fried, they are filled with, if they need to, with the different kinds of fillings.
What's been the reason you think that Springfield developed such a successful company making donuts and other products?
I guess it was just Kelly Grant Sr.'s drive that when he first started out, he told me that he was doing it to make a living for his family. But he grew and the business grew with it because he took the time to do it. And do it consistently, and he always believed in good stuff to make a good donut. And I think people just got to like them, and it just business has just grown over the years.
But other towns in Central Illinois haven't developed a donut franchise. They haven't had the, for some reason, the demand or the interest that we've seen here in Springfield.
Well, again, I think it took a lot of drive by the people that ran this company. A lot of times people get into this business and they're short-term people. They're not interested in doing it for a long period of time. And it takes that in order to do this. At one time, we used to make lots and lots of cream puffs. I mean, I'm talking, we'd make cabinetfuls. Now we make a pan or so, and that's all. As time has gone on, we've learned that you need to do some things differently, and it's changed what's there.
What's the most popular product?
I think the most popular donut is your glaze. It always has been. We probably sell more of them than anything else.
Recently, there's been another donut from another company. You know what I'm talking about, Krispy Kreme. And they've received a lot of notoriety. Can you compare the two products? Have you ever sampled the other?
Yeah, I have. I think ours is still better. I mean, ours keeps longer. Where theirs, after a while, theirs starts to get dried, and it's not near as good. And so if you don't get it when it's nice and fresh, it's not very good.
Now, this recent emphasis on reduced carbs, has that impacted sales?
I think it's probably affected a little bit, but people like donuts. Instead of having two, just have one. That's all it takes.
That was Tony Bauer, baker for Mellow Cream Donuts in Springfield. He talked with Jiffy Johnson. You're listening to Sidetrack. Last month marked the 30th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War, when Saigon fell to North Vietnamese troops. Ron Yates had been in Southeast Asia for several weeks reporting for the Chicago Tribune. He headed to South Vietnam when it became clear that the long war was ending, and ending badly for U.S. troops. He was among the last American reporters, soldiers, and diplomats to flee, along with thousands of South Vietnamese families, a fraction of those who wanted to leave. Yates is now dean at the University of Illinois College of Communication. He recalls that final day with AM580's Tom Rogers.
Ron Yates was jolted from his sleep in his hotel room in the heart of Saigon on this day 30 years ago.
Around 4 o'clock in the morning, we came under a really heavy barrage of artillery and rocket attack. Most of it was on the outskirts of Saigon, especially around Tan Son Nhut, which is the airbase. But a few made their way in toward the center of the town, and I remember, sitting up in my bed, and there was plaster falling off the ceilings along with a bunch of gecko lizards and everything else onto the bed. And I thought to myself, this is not good. And I went out and looked out the window, and all the Home Guard troops, these are mostly teenagers in Saigon at the time, were running around shooting in the air. shooting anywhere, you know. And I hollered down at one of them because I knew some of them. I used to pay them to take me to the PTT office to file my stories after curfew because there was a curfew on, and you didn't want to be out after curfew unless you were escorted. And I said, "What's going on?" And this kid named Na yelled up and says, "Beaucoup VC, many VC." I said, "What? Where?" And he said, "Everywhere." And they were just shooting indiscriminately, and bullets were ricocheting off buildings. And I said, "This is absurd. You know, I'm getting back inside." And finally, things calmed down. Obviously, the North Vietnamese were not in the city at that point. They were still way out. But that's the kind of panic that existed within the city. People were terrified. They thought for sure they were all going to be executed, and, you know, because they were South Vietnamese.
Evacuation plans were sketchy. Yates says he never heard the radio broadcast of the song White Christmas that was to signal the final exit. Still, he and others knew they had to go somewhere.
There were certain evacuation points where the press corps were supposed to go. And we went to the first one, and we couldn't go out of that one because it was a building on the Saigon River, which was above that building was another building, and on top of that building were 50 caliber machine guns facing right at the helipad. So we decided we're not going to go out from there. We better go someplace else. And we wandered around the city for about an hour. And finally, I went to the embassy, thought I might be able to get into the embassy, but there must have been 20,000 people outside the embassy, you know, screaming and yelling and throwing things and trying to get over the wall. And I said, "I'm not going to get through that crowd," you know. In fact, I was embarrassed. I didn't want to be the American who goes, "Let me through. I'm going into the embassy." And all these Vietnamese were outside the wall. I just couldn't do that. We jumped on a bus. The bus was an old military bus. And the Marine who was driving it said, "We're headed for Tan Sanut," which is the airbase. The airbase at the time was under tremendous attack. I mean, just incredible. The 130-millimeter artillery shells landing on the runway. It was just a horrendous place to be going into. And I thought to myself, "This is nuts. Why would I want to go out here?" But it was the only place you could go because it was the only place that could, where these big CH-53 Sea Stallion heavy choppers could land. These are big helicopters that will carry about 75 people. And as we pulled up to the gate of Tan Sanut, at least the military portion of the gate, the guards began shooting at our bus, or shooting over the bus, trying to make us go away. And we stopped and parked the bus, actually backed it up a little bit. And the Marine who was on board the bus with us had a two-way radio, and his code name was Wagon Master. And he yelled. He yelled in the radio to the DAO compound, which is the defense attaché office. Says, "What should we be doing? What should we do?" And the guy says, "You know, I can't tell you. He says, I would just ram the gate and get through it." So the bus backed up, and the trounced the accelerator. The bus lurched forward. We were hitting about 60 miles an hour. We were all below the window wells. We didn't want to be above the windows. And I thought for sure we were going to get peppered. And inexplicably, as we got right to the gates, the guards threw the gates open. We went roaring through. I popped up, and to the left, there was a helicopter that had just been shot down. We looked up in the air, and there was a C-119 taking off from the airfield. And I was really surprised to see this thing taking off because I don't know how the hell they got it up in the air, you know, because there were a lot of holes, craters everywhere on the runway. He gets up in the air, probably approaching 2,000 feet. And a SAM goes up and knocks it right down. And we see this thing get hit and fall right back into an area of Cholon, which was a sort of like the Chinese sector of Saigon.
Yates's bus makes it to the defense attaché office as rockets and mortars explode nearby. The evacuees were issued name tags to attach to themselves, the same tags that were used to identify bodies. They awaited a helicopter to get them out to sea to a waiting carrier.
We got out to a what they call a platform landing ship dock, and it was a ship called the USS Denver. And we landed on the deck of that thing, and for the next couple of hours watched just a steady stream of Hueys, hit choppers from, you know, Air America choppers, South Vietnamese Army choppers coming in and landing. And as soon as they would land, they'd push them over the side because they had no room for them. And at some point, they decided we can't even let them land on the deck anymore. So they said, no, you can't land. So the choppers would fly near the carrier and tilt over, and they would open the door, and then he would move the stick in the other direction, and the chopper would tilt this way, and then he would jump out. And not only by themselves, but their families, children and women and everybody jumping out of these choppers at 20, 25 feet up. And the chopper would peel off and go the other way, and they would fall this way. And sometimes I thought these people were not going to make it because the rotors came flying down into the water and hit within, 15, 20 feet from these people. It was really, I couldn't believe it.
How many people eventually made it out on that day, are you aware of?
There were about 1,300. There actually were 1,300, according to the official count, 1,373 Americans got out on the final day, and 5,680 Vietnamese got out on the final 24 hours.
And many were left behind.
And, thousands were left behind. And, that's the sad thing about it is, from an American point of view, I felt really guilty about it, As a journalist, often you feel guilty when you're covering war or any kind of a catastrophe like that. I can't help feeling guilty because I know I can leave. Those people cannot. That's where they live. That's their home. They have no way of getting out. And I always knew I could come in there, do my work, and I could leave again and go back to something better. Those people had nothing to look forward to other than many of them prison. And they put them. They didn't call these things prison. They called them re-education camps. But when I went back again in '85, I think as many as 50,000-60,000 people were scattered around Vietnam in re-education camps. Still, 10 years later, doing hard labor.
Today, Vietnam is trying to develop a market economy and improve its relations with the U.S. And Yates says when you ask its residents about the war now, they say they don't have time to think about the past. Living for today is more important. I'm Tom Rogers, AM 580 News.
You can hear the complete interview with Ron Yates on the news page of our website at will.uiuc.edu. This is Sidetrack. Pope John Paul II's wake and funeral put the ritualistic viewing of the dead back on the front page. More than 1 million faithful made the personal pilgrimage to the Vatican to see the Pope's body. Meanwhile, overflow crowds gathered at Chicago's Museum of Science and Industry to stream past and mull over the remains of total strangers. But the dearly departed at the museum weren't laid out in pillowed coffins in their finest outfits. They were bent and shaped, cut away and exploded, in full view with nothing to hide. They are the stars of Body Worlds, the brainchild of controversial German professor Günther von Hagens. The bodies are preserved through a process called plastination. Body tissue is infused with resins and polymers that allow the cadavers to be dissected, posed, and then put on display, allowing an incredible look inside the human body. But is it too much? Can we overexpose the wonders of nature? While providing a marvelous teaching tool for medical professionals, is it anything more than curiosity bordering on voyeurism for the general public? AM580's Mike Sola ponders some of those issues.
Your personal history will influence your body world's experience. For me, when I first got a driver's license, it meant driving my mom to wakes and funerals. Most of the deceased were strangers to me, family friends or business associates from a time long past. After extending my condolences to the family and saying a few silent words of best wishes over the body, I'd slip a memorial card into my pocket and wait for Mom and the drive home. It was never morbid, just a way of honoring friendship, showing support, and saying goodbye. Body Worlds is not about saying goodbye, but rather it's a greeting, an in-your-face introduction to advanced anatomy from once living mannequins freeze-framed in poses designed to focus on the miraculous mechanics and unique engineering of the human machine. But I kept looking at the faces, devoid of skin but still the place for the first impression of a stranger. The faceless exhibits may have provided more insight into the physical marvels for me because I wasn't distracted by the face, or rather the front of the skull. I attended Body Worlds with my wife and two daughters. There were several youngsters there free of close adult scrutiny, and evidently they were curious about the differences between the sexes, and it is a difference that remains very obvious even when the skin is no longer in place. If you have children and are planning to attend Body Worlds, I suggest getting that birds and bees talk out of the way before you go, or you could use the visual aids and address the issue at the museum. Maybe viewing plastinates at a young age will inspire one to a medical career. It was interesting eavesdropping on a heart surgeon pointing out intricate internal workings in an impromptu lecture to a younger physician, the unobstructed vantage point into the chest cavity surpassing any textbook view. But again, my attention went back to the face and the eyes. My thoughts were a hope that this person didn't arrive at this less than peaceful final resting place through some unfortunate incident. Obviously, the heart thing contributed to his death, but to be put on display? Did he lose a wager? Or was this a chance to gain the limelight that had eluded him during his living days? Well, I had back surgery about 10 years ago, and I seemed to gravitate to the exhibits that revealed the jigsaw puzzle of the lower spine. I also noticed that a middle-aged woman, aided by a walker, shared my interest. To gaze on a region that is a personal source of pain or restriction with unrestrained clarity is a true benefit of Body Worlds. One thing we all share is the birth experience. One of the displays is that of a woman who died in her 8th month of pregnancy. And while the Museum of Science and Industry has long been the home to a display of human fetuses in advancing stages, this is more than specimens inside glass jars. You look on a life ended in its tracks before it had a chance to experience the world outside the womb. Body Worlds is a captivating and incredible experience. You might find yourself looking past the reality that at one time these displays were someone's son or daughter. You may be able to frame the scenes with the simple but exotic wonderment that the human body provides. While examining the winged man, with his individual muscle groups of the upper torso stretched out, looking almost bat-like, another patron said to me, "This goes beyond medicine or science and is truly art." I was intrigued. I was educated, at times even mesmerized by the Body Worlds exhibit, and perhaps some of my habits may change after viewing the direct effects lifestyle choices can have on the body. But when I left, something was missing. Then it occurred to me, because of the many funeral road trips with my mother, maybe I needed a memorial card to take away from the visit.
AM 580's Mike Sola. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. A freshman at Eastern Illinois University says when sitting down for lunch in his dorm cafeteria, he never dreamt that he'd find a hot item for online bidders. Jeff Bossert spoke with E.G. Rosenmoy, who found that his lunch closely resembled the late pontiff, Pope John Paul II.
Did this at all come from the fact that there has been, in recent history, pieces of food that looked like other celebrities? David Letterman has kind of mocked this whole idea on his show, or is this just, or did it just come to you out of the blue?
Well, it did look like the Pope, but the idea to sell it came from the success of all the other ones on eBay.
And again, you made, let's see, over $230?
$232.50.
You know what the Golden Palace Casino was? It was an internet casino, right? So, what are their plans for this?
Well, I'm assuming they're just using it for promotion. I really don't know what they're going to do with it. But supposedly they use it for promotion and raise money for charities and stuff. So, kill two birds with one stone. They get their name out and they make money for charity.
Now, did you get this, like, in the cafeteria at school? Or
yeah.
What? And did it just immediately strike you as something that resembled John Paul II?
Well, I right out of the, right off the bat, I noticed it looked like a man. And then, I was just reading the newspaper right before lunch. I just started looking like, kind of looks like the Pope.
And did you have friends there that supported you? Yeah, put this on eBay.
Yeah, I showed it to my buddy. I'm like, doesn't that kind of look like the Pope? He's like, yeah, I guess.
Are you Catholic?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Are there a lot of bids for this?
59, I believe.
And started out at what, 90?
99 cents.
Okay. How long did it take for it to get up to that 232.50?
Golden Palace put the bid, their winning bid, in about in the last minute, about 20 seconds from the end, I think.
So is this going to have you, I guess, on the lookout for maybe something else in the future that might resemble some celebrity figure?
Yeah, I've been double-checking my food before I eat it.
And as we speak, you're getting ready to take it up to Champaign to ship.
Yeah.
Well, and tell me a little bit about this whole just celebrity experience. I mean, you're a minor celebrity, I guess. Is it been kind of cool that you have a message on your machine from some newspaper?
I never thought I'd receive this much media attention for it. I never thought I'd make it this big. Just kind of put up there hoping I'd get something for it, and it worked out.
Do you look at yourself as kind of a creative guy? Is this related to, are you an art major or something like that?
No, I can't draw for, I can't, but I do like doing creative stuff like that.
Well, I'm reading that you're an undecided major, so maybe you look at this and think maybe you should go into advertising or something.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people have been telling me I should go into marketing.
Where are you from?
Skokie.
Your roommate's probably to the point where he wants to get some of that 232.50 back for all the messages he's taken from media.
Yeah, I usually don't have classes till noon, and people just call me. One day, like the day after it sold, I had 4 calls before I even got out of bed. 4 like interviews.
And what are you planning to spend? Are you just putting your $232.50 back into paying for, you know, what every college student spends his money on?
Yeah, I'm giving about $50 to charity, and the rest just for, you know, just for paying for college and you know, just normal things.
Honestly, I can't think of a whole lot else to tell you. I mean, unless you can add anything about this experience, advice you can impart to someone else on what they might, when they're eating, what they should look out for.
Yeah, just double-check your food and get creative.
Jeff Bossert spoke with E.G. Rosen-Moy, the Eastern Illinois University freshman whose lunch recently netted him more than $230 on eBay. Online casino GoldenPalace.com won the item after 59 bids. To view the famous piece of poultry, visit popechickenbreast.com. Still to come on the program, we preview some of the records that'll be on sale at this year's Vintage Vinyl, and we hear a commentary from engineer Bill Hammack. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. When you drive up Route 45 to the north side of Urbana, you might catch a glimpse of small aircraft landing at Frasca Airport. Just to the west is a building that has a lot to do with airplanes, but their machines never leave the ground. It's the home of Frasca International. They manufacture flight simulators used all over the world, and these simulators are a lot more high-tech than you might think.
My name is Peggy Pritchard. I'm the advertising manager at Frasca. We manufacture flight simulators for flight schools, airlines, and military organizations around the world.
So tell me a little bit about the company.
The company was founded in about 1958 by Rudy Frasca, and he started out working for Link Simulation, training military pilots that were World War II pilots going into the Korean War. And that's how he started. Then he came to the University of Illinois and worked in the aviation psychology department, and then decided to create his own flight simulator and started in his garage, and then moved several times, and now we're here in Urbana. We moved out here about 1980, built this facility, and no, that was 1990 we came out here. Now we've got about 2,000 devices in about 70 countries around the world. Like I said, airlines, flight schools, military organizations, anyone that does pilot training would use our flight simulators.
So we're out here in a big warehouse, sort of, why don't you describe what we're looking at right now here on the floor?
This is the, we call the high bay. Obviously it's a lot taller, so we can build motion simulators back here. We've got flight training devices, which are fixed base simulators. We've got several under construction, various stages of development right now. Some of them are actual aircraft cockpits that we get from salvage, then we build the instrumentation inside. Some of them are fiberglass shells. It just kind of depends on what the customer wants, what their budget is, and what their requirements are for certification. They have to work with sometimes the FAA or whatever their country is to have a governing authority. So whatever they want, we build it to their specifications. These are some of our, some are more standardized devices, some are more customized devices.
And they're in all different stages of creation.
Yeah. If we come back around here, I can show you one that's in a visual shell. So it's got a visual system that wraps around, and that way you can see as you're flying what it's going to be looking like outside. We've got some customers here flying. They're flying a helicopter simulator, and it's got a TrueVision wraparound visual display system.
It's like a giant movie screen, basically.
It's like a giant movie screen, and we use satellite technology, so when you're actually flying, whatever, say you, we have a customer in Japan, Florida, wherever, we get satellite technology for the visual system database, so when they're flying over what would be the actual terrain, so they're learning to fly the traffic patterns where they're from.
And it, beyond the, just the sort of shell of the aircraft and the instruments of the aircraft, there's a lot of, I see, computer technology hooked up with this as well, sort of standalone.
Yeah. Quite a bit of computer technology. We have a lot of software engineers working for us, aeronautical engineers, over half of our staff are engineers. So we start out when we get an order, several months of work is done on the software before it becomes anything you can actually get into and fly.
So how has this changed over the last years and the last decades?
Oh, gosh. Started out analog technology. Now it's digital technology. This visual system you see in front of you, that's just been around a couple of years. Used to be a system like this would cost many millions of dollars. Now it's much less than that. We have instrumentation is going to, instead of just multiple small instruments, they have what's called advanced avionics in the training aircraft. So they were trying to train pilots on like GPS, global positioning systems in the aircraft, where years ago they didn't have that. There's just so much new technology. Whenever the airplanes change, the simulators have to change to go along with it.
But in the old days, did they actually have the simulators like that rocked back
they
and forth?
They did, but now it's a lot different. We don't have one in the building here, but there's six-axis motion bases that are on hydraulics, and so they'll move. Even if you're just taxiing, you'll feel the runway bumps. You'll feel turbulence. It really does replicate the flight.
The thing I see is very interesting. On this screen with this helicopter simulation, you actually see the shadows of the helicopter blades at the top of the screen.
Right, you do. And you'll see shadows, like when you're flying an airplane, you'll see the shadow on the ground if the sun's right overhead. You'll see traffic, other aircraft traffic. You'll see buildings and weather. We can simulate all kinds of weather. This is a graphical instructor station. The instructor can sit here and position the aircraft in wherever he wants it to be in the pattern. They can do failures, engine failures. They can simulate any kind of weather, crosswinds, instrument failures, change the performance constants for different types of aircraft. So the instructor can sit here and just set up the training scenario for the pilot. So if they're having a problem with a particular part of the flight, the instructor can have them do that over and over again. And at the end of the session, then they can get a printout that tells them how they did. And that's our graphical instructor station. And that's something we invented about 10 years ago.
So how big is the flight simulator business?
Oh, gosh. I just got back from a convention in Dallas last week. I mean, it's worldwide. There are companies that are multi-billion-dollar companies. Now, this is a much smaller company, and it's family-owned. But anyone who does flight training, like any airline, any military, they use simulators. So it's a big industry, but there's not a ton of people who do it.
So how many simulators do you have in production at any given time?
Oh, it's hard to say, because you'll get an order, and then, like I said, it'll take several months before you actually get into the phase where you're out here on the floor building them. But internally, doing software, you know, we probably deliver between 60 and 100 a year. And it just depends on how the orders come in. Sometimes you'll be working on an order and you won't get the actual order for several months or over a year. And then sometimes we've had times when we've got a backlog. So it's cyclical, like any business.
And the actual start to finish production time for a simulator?
It varies. We have some that are kind of what we call the off-the-shelf models, and we can deliver in 30 days if we've got some in, you know, close to production. Custom orders can take several months to over a year.
And how much do these simulators run?
They start, we have a new model that our lowest price model is about $50,000, and then we've sold them up to $8 million. I would say probably we have a huge niche in the university market. Probably in the United States, 95% of the colleges that have a simulator have a Frasca, so that's a huge market for us. Like I said, helicopters has become really important for us.
Have you done any flying in one of these simulators?
Yes, I have. I don't get in them very often, but we had one that went out. It was a six-axis motion for our Cessna Caravan, and I got in the back of that and went for a ride, and we were doing some filming, and the guy was trying to show a lot of motion, so it got very bouncy back there. He was showing turbulence, so it is very realistic. If you're a pilot and you get in any of these, it's like flying the airplane.
That was Peggy Pritchard giving me a tour of Frasca International. This is Sidetrack. What makes a scientific essay written some four decades ago worth $10,000? Engineer Bill Hammack has the answer.
Last week, the chipmaker Intel paid $10,000 for an original copy of a 40-year-old electronics magazine. It contained an article of faith for the company, founder Gordon Moore's famous law about computing power. His wonderfully titled article, cramming more components onto integrated circuits, predicted that about every year the number would double. It's held up pretty well, with computing power doubling every 18 months. In 1964, a computer chip had about 50 transistors. Now they cram 500 million. For the consumer, this means that every year and a half, a home computer becomes twice as powerful for the same amount of money. Also, Moore's law applies to other computer-based devices, hard drives and cell phones, for example. Chip makers remain sure they can do this yearly doubling for about 5 more years, but after that it's pretty dicey. No technology clearly stands out for continuing this explosive growth of computing power, cheap growth, that is. This means consumers will feel it in their pocketbook if Moore's law stalls. They'll be stuck with a personal computer of 2010, and if they move, for example, into digital photography and advanced imaging, they'll find no cheap solutions for storing large numbers of photos beyond that age's capability. And for the investor, the center of gravity of the electronics industry will shift in both hardware and software. For hardware, advances in computing will come from outside the single-chip computer, the Intels of the world. The companies that thrive will be those that develop more intelligent peripherals, offloading work from the computer's processor. And Moore's law gave us bad software. Instead of writing efficient code, programmers just waited until the computers got faster. I'm reminded of Blaise Pascal's comment 3 centuries ago. Apologizing for a verbose letter, he wrote, "I have only made this letter longer because I have not had the time to make it shorter." Letters like software take time to shorten and condense. So software giants like Microsoft find it better to write just good enough programs that rely on advances by Intel to make them run efficiently. The current giants might be displaced by nimble companies that take the time to write efficient software. And when the age of Moore's Law ends, we may well be telling our children unbelievable tales about how in our day, computing got bigger and better every year.
The comments of Bill Hammack, who teaches chemical engineering at UIUC. His essays on engineering and life, which to him are one and the same, can also be found on his website, engineerguy.com. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. Joining me in the studio right now is Brian Robertson. He is the coordinator for WILL's Vintage Vinyl Sale, which will be happening later on in the month. And he has actually brought some stuff for us to listen to, and we'll tell you all about the Vintage Vinyl Sale. But first of all, hello, Brian.
How you doing, Jason?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining us here. Now, as I said, you did bring a stack of records for us.
A stack of good finds that you never know what you're going to find, and this is what I found and thought I'd bring in and let you listen to and see what we found, because I don't really know myself.
Well, this is stuff that has actually been donated for the sale and will actually be available for purchase.
All donations, yeah.
If people, you know, once we get done with this, you're going to take them back to Lincoln Square
Village.
Yeah,
these will all be available for purchase, and I'm sure people will want them.
Okay, so I'm intrigued by this first one on the top there.
First, we've got Telly Savalas.
Star of Kojak and
yeah.
Big Hollywood star on top of that.
And he's singing all the hits and some that aren't so much hits. But, well, I don't know what we've got here, but he's looking pretty smooth on the cover.
Okay, let me get a copy of this. Oh, he does. He has that Who Loves You Baby sort of
yeah.
look for him going on. Okay. Oh, here's one. You've Lost That Loving Feeling.
Oh, we got to hear that.
Yeah, okay. So let me move on over here. Get it set up. Okay. Telly Savalas, You've Lost That Loving Feeling.
You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips. And there's no tenderness like before in your fingertips. You're trying hard not to show it. Baby, baby, I know it.
You've lost that loving feeling. Whoa, that loving feeling. You've lost that loving feeling. Now it's gone, gone, gone. Ooh.
Wow. That is absolutely beautiful there. Let me get that off the record player.
I think I've lost that love and feeling.
You know, get that back in the sleeve. We'll put that over here. You mentioned when we just turned off the mics while listening to that, he came from the William Shatner School of Singing.
Yeah, very much reminded me of William Shatner until he gets the chorus there, and then he really got into it.
You know, the thing that actually surprises me is that record has been played many times by the sounds of it.
Someone enjoyed it, and someone will still be able to enjoy it, because it's got many years of playing left, I have a feeling.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the great things about vintage vinyl, is you go there, and you absolutely have no idea what you're going to find. It's sort of a discovery, a treasure hunt.
Yeah, we always think each year we're going to get less and less albums, and we keep getting more and more. So there's always stuff out there, and it's always good to get people donating them and other people to pick them up and do something with them.
Well, see, I'm a big fan of vinyl records. I you know, never lost my thrill of them. And I would love that Telly Savalas album. I might have to get in line and search for that one, because, you know, I love that cool and strange, and you never know what people have done.
Exactly.
In the history of their careers.
I had never seen this before in my life.
Okay, well, let's grab another one over
there
off the stack.
What we've got here is George Benson, along with Herbie Hancock and some other jazz aficionados, doing a, well, I'll let you take a look at it, Jason,
right,
here.
It is George Benson, White Rabbit from, let's see if there's a date in here, from, I think, 1971.
Oh,
so
wow.
it's sort of that, 70s jazz funk thing.
Perfect.
Okay, well, let's see. Let's take a look at this one. George Benson, I actually really admire him as a jazz performer. He did a lot of great stuff in the 70s, sort of that West Montgomery school of West
yeah.
Coast cool. Oh, this is a beautiful. Look how pristine that vinyl
is. Oh, shiny.
Okay, let's get that here on the record player. All right, this is the title track, White Rabbit, the George Benson album. Here we go. Yeah, I really got that Spanish guitar thing. I'm gonna fast forward a little bit in the song.
Yeah, let's see where this goes.
Okay, all right, hold on. All right. Oh, yeah, much better.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's much, much better. I like that. That's really cool. Let me get that off the record player here. That definitely has that Herbie Hancock, big funk of the early 70s. That's
great, fast-moving piano.
Oh, I like that a lot. That's good. And, I'm looking on the back here, and there's only like 5 songs on the whole album. And I wish we had time to play more, because it looks like on side 2, the start of side 2 is California Dreaming.
Ooh.
It's a 7-minute version of California Dreaming.
Perfect.
Wow.
That'll make you dream of California.
And this record is almost mint. It's absolutely beautiful.
It's very
good. I'm gonna be very careful putting it back in its sleeve here. The Telly Savalas one, well played, but this one is beautiful.
Somebody took good care of that album.
Yeah. My guess is this a record like this might actually go into the collector's corner.
Yeah, that's one that you'll probably find in the collector's corner. That's what we do is we pull out stuff that's a little bit more collectible, people are more interested in, and rather than pricing it for $1 a disc like we do everything else, it's a little bit more pricey, but it's generally worth it and still a good deal.
And that stuff is amazing too, what you find in the collector's corner.
Oh, it's, yeah, we've already found a old Woody Guthrie 78 and what else, a Lead Belly. Another Lead Belly 78. So
wow.
Just some of the older, really vintage stuff that you find is, it's unbelievable that it's still around, that it survived this long.
And again, one of the great pleasures of going to this vintage vinyl sale is, again, you never know what you're going to find.
Yeah.
Jazz albums, like we heard there.
Lots of jazz. Some blues. We've got quite a few blues albums this year. Rock, pop. Course, always popular.
Huge classical music section.
Lots and lots of classical, good opera, lots of easy listening, so all those Herb Alpert fans out there.
Herb Alpert and the Tijuana.
We've got lots of whipped cream albums.
Yeah. Easy listening is actually one of my favorites, along with the Hawaiian albums.
Well, just the covers themselves.
Oh, man, I love that
Soft
stuff.
Soft Focus and Bubbles and who knows, everything.
I love that stuff so much. And these are all very popular genres because people just like flock. People usually like pick a genre that they love,
and they will go through
the
whole
thing.
And
when those doors open, because people line up really early.
Yeah, people are, I think someone said, the first person in line last year said they had been there since 5 a.m., I think.
And the sale doesn't open till 8.
Till 8, yes.
Wow. But so, I know, when those doors open, people run to those sections that
yes.
they love. And I know that one section, because I'm looking at the next album on the stack, that one section that people absolutely love is the comedy section.
Lots of good comedy, old George Carlin and Steve Martin, and like what we've got here, the Fire Sign Theater.
Yeah, these guys, people still love them. You know, comedy records, in my experience, you know, are sort of a mixed bag because a lot of records sound really dated to our modern ears.
Right.
And a lot of stuff still sounds fresh and funny, even though it's from that time period. And I think these guys are a great example.
They are.
Even though, you know, you can tell they're from their era, their stuff is still kind of wild. And which one would we get here? Presenting Waiting for the Electrician or someone like him. And oh, there's a cool picture here on the back. I got to play this one. It says W.C. Fields Forever. So let me slide this one out of the jacket here. All right, the Fire Sign Theater, here we go.
Hey, baby. Welcome to the lazy old Magic Circle Dews Ranch and Collective Love Farm. Take off your clothes and come on in. Om Range. Here, let me lay a stick of sandalwood incense on you. Made it out of my old sandals. No. Let me light it for you. Yeah. Nah. Let me show you around the place a little bit. Oh, wow. Hey, man, where are all those little people with the melty hats and the walls? Hey, man, now that you are so old, down home, tribal and all that, I'm going to take you up to the second bardo and orient you. Here's our Good Games People playroom.
Hello, my name is Mello Jello. I am the head of the athletic department. I hate the athletic department. I am the athletic department head, here. Oh, okay, beginners, everybody into the full lotus position. Ah! Oh, yes. Oh, that's very good. Yes, that's very good. Now you are going
to... Man, again, I wish we could play all of this.
I forgot about all the sound effects that they use,
yeah.
too. You know, it's like an old radio program.
Uh-huh, and, you know, just the sort of in-jokes from their era.
Yeah.
You know, oh... This is fun, and you know, you always find good stuff in the comedy section. I know from experience,
yes.
You always find good
and
stuff.
And you never know what you're going to find.
And again, you never know what you're going to find. So tell us, I know we've been talking about the vintage vinyl sale here for a little bit, so tell us the when and the where and all that information, so when people want to go to this and get these albums, they know exactly where to go.
It's going to be on Saturday, May 21st at Lincoln Square Village. It's in the old M2 Bridal Space, for those of you who are familiar with the Lincoln Square Mall.
The same place as last year.
Same place as last year. Same place as the year before that, too. So it's our third year there now. And it starts at 8 a.m. It goes till 7 p.m. At 4:30, we shut down for a half an hour, kind of straighten things up, and open back up at 5 for a half price sale. So between 5 and 7, everything's half price.
But, you know, I have to tell you, and I have to tell everyone listening, that if you are really serious about this, if you really want to go there, my advice, go early before the doors open. Get a place in line. You will meet people who do this every year.
Oh, yeah.
Because the best stuff, and I'm not joking, is gone within the first hour.
It goes very quickly. You'd be amazed. It's just, it's fun. I love working the day of the sale because, you know, that's what we've prepared for. And it's just a great, great time watching everybody get everything that they want and try to find
it.
The
big stacks of records, people. Now, not only records, there's other stuff available too.
Yeah, we've got all kinds for audiophiles, records, CDs, tapes, 8-tracks, stereo equipment, whatever stereo equipment that people have donated. We have somebody kind of check it over, see how it's working, so you kind of know what you're getting into before you buy it. And we always get all kinds of nice record players and a lot of times really nice speakers.
Oh, yeah,
and
definitely. I again, from experience, because I've gone to quite a few of these, the stereo equipment that can be found there are some really amazing amplifiers. And
yeah.
Yeah, it's such amazing stuff. So this is I'm getting very excited about this. I hope people who are tuning in are getting very excited. And why don't we play one more thing off the pile there? And you know, I've been kind of looking at this when you walked
in.
Yeah,
this is
and this thing is
hot find. I think I'd heard about it and I'd never seen it. It's R. Crumb, the great illustrator from San Francisco.
That's right, the underground cartoonist and the guy who was the subject of the movie Crumb.
Yes.
A while back. R. Crumb and his Cheap Suit Serenaders, and I believe a mention of this, if not a performance of this, was in that movie.
Yes, it was.
So this is absolutely, and he has his own little cartoons on
the
back.
Yeah, he's got
too.
His cartoons on the back, so it's worth it just to see the album cover alone, let alone hear it, you know.
1974 is when this was made, so it's a 30-year-old album.
It is.
And it looks beautiful, and okay, we're going to play a track off of
all
this.
All right.
Okay, here's the track off of side two, track cut one. I'm gonna get it. Okay, let me put this on. R. Crumb. And I guess if you're lucky, you just might get this record.
That's right.
R. Crumb and his Cheap Suit Serenaders. Well, Brian, thanks a lot for coming in and bringing all these great albums with you.
Well, thank you, Jason.
Brian Robertson, he is the coordinator for WILL's Vintage Vinyl, which is happening on May 21st. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website. And a lot of our past shows are also available as MP3 downloads. Just go to will.uiuc.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.